today, a Mother's Day edition of KRCB's A Novel Idea. We feature the author of Bad Mother and Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, Ilette Waldman, in conversation with Rosemary Manchester on her just-released novel, Love and Treasure. Longtime writer, activist, and friend to KRCB, Jenny Orvino, and sexuality educator and advocate, Remy Newman, join me later in the show and talk about steamy Sonoma County's Menage a Mai, erotic literary soiree. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a Mother's Day edition and a novel idea. Ilette Waldman is an outspoken, fierce, and energetic writer whose main purview has been writing novels about families and motherhood. She gained notoriety when she said that she loved her husband more than her four children, which led her directly to the Oprah Winfrey Show to defend herself. Now she's come out with a triptych of a novel, Love and Treasure, which weaves a story around the true history of the Hungarian gold train of looted property of the Jews murdered during the Holocaust. The story is historical, atmospheric, tragic, and romantic at the same time. Before we get to Rosemary Manchester and Ilette Waldman, I want to invite you to support KRCB and A Novel Idea through your financial pledge of support. We continue to bring you new and established authors, local writers, and those of international renown. A quality of KRCB is our curiosity in music, culture, art, politics, and our desire to stimulate your curiosity, too. Please call us right now, this moment, at 707-584-2020. $60 is just $5 a month. It's quick and easy to do, and you will become a vital part of this rich community of public radio in Sonoma County. Visit our website and pledge online at krcb.org. We appreciate your support of this show and all the unique literary, cultural, and music programming found right here on KRCB. We're the new 91. And now, graduate of Harvard Law School, classmate of Barack Obama, chum of Hillary Clinton, and author of Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace, Ilette Waldman is in conversation with literary gadfly Rosemary Manchester on Waldman's latest novel, Love and Treasure.
I love your title. It says it all.
You know, it's really funny because I was trying to figure out the title for this book, and I was talking to a few different writers, and it was actually a friend of mine, the writer Jonathan Lethem, I think, who came up with the final title. What he actually came up with was Love, comma, Treasure. And while I like that, I decided that I needed an ampersand in the middle to make it easier to say. So I have him to thank for it, which is great.
Yeah, and you're right. People might think that meant love treasure.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
I think he was thinking of the sort of Nabokov speak memory, which is right. One of my favorite books. But,
of course.
You know, far be it for me to presume on Vladimir Nabokov's, you know, in his steps. So I thought, I think Love and Treasure is great. I had a moment of hesitation because I wrote a book that is called Love and Other Impossible Pursuits. But
right.
I didn't pick that title. My then editor did. And I've always, I called that book Love and Other Impossible to Remember titles. So I decided that I I didn't love the idea of two titles that began with love, but on the other hand, I didn't want to sacrifice a perfect title because of a prior title that I didn't like so much. So right. I just went with it.
Right. And then people will make an association and they'll say, yes,
perhaps okay. They will.
Yes. It's a kind of a change for you to be writing this particular book about the Holocaust, is it?
Yes. I think it's more of a progression. You know, I started out writing sort of funny, entertaining little murder mysteries. And as my work has gotten more and more serious and more ambitious, I think this is just, for me, I like to think of it as the next step. And
yes.
It's certainly, I think, my best book. For a while, I thought it was the best book I could ever write and I should never bother writing again. But I think that was a very elaborate form of procrastination. So now I no longer think that, and I think I have to get back to work. But I'm definitely very proud of it.
Right. Oh, yes, it's marvelous. I want to digress just a little bit and ask you about the I know that our listeners will associate your name with the books about mothers and children and
yes.
husbands and wives. And could we talk?
And there is nary a mother or a child in this whole book. You know, it was funny. Once an interviewer once asked me many years ago, well, you always write about motherhood. Is that a problem for you? And I got very irritated. And I said, look, the world is full of writers who only ever write about one thing. I mean, take the great Philip Roth, for example. He only ever writes about one thing. And nobody seems to have a problem with that. Maybe it's because that one thing is men scrambling to have sex with younger women. But my one thing happens to be motherhood, which is no less legitimate. And then, lo and behold, now I've written a book that has nothing to do with motherhood. I think the truth is you write what you are consumed by. And I have four children. So
yes.
for many, many years, mm-hmm. motherhood seemed like mm-hmm. the defining part of my identity in my life. And so much so that I couldn't even imagine thinking about anything else, really. And then, but, you know, your kids grow up and mm-hmm. they move out. And my eldest is in her freshman year of college, and I've been able to turn my attention to other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not for very long. You know, if I stop paying attention to them for, you know, too long at a time, they immediately have some crisis that forces me back.
Mm-hmm. I have four children as well.
Oh, you do?
Yes. Mine were in a much briefer period of time, so they're all, you know, very, very close together in age.
How many years apart?
They were all within 6 years.
So mine were all within eight, which means I had a little breather in the middle.
Is that? I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you weren't quite as
no crazy
as
in the middle
as I was, but it does take your life over.
It does. You know, it was funny. Their writers, I can think of one in particular, Richard Ford, who always said that he didn't have children because he had books instead. And I do think I've come to the conclusion that if you are a writer who is a parent, mother or father, but particularly a mother, unless you are terribly neglectful, every child costs you a book. But you know what? It's worth it.
It's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. at the end of my life, I hope to be very, very proud of all the books I've written. But, you know, your book doesn't hold your hand on your deathbed, and I certainly hope that, you know, at least one of my four children will. Mm-hmm. You know, you have enough of them so that if you make terrible mistakes, your odds are better of one of them at least liking you.
People got so excited about some of your writing about motherhood and marriage.
Yes,
and really
they did,
took
didn't
umbrage.
Well, people like to take umbrage, don't they?
Yes,
I mean, it's like it's one of the favorite activities of. I mean,
oh,
I know personally, I am deeply fond of the taking of umbrage.
Yes, they did.
Certainly when I wrote an essay that many years ago that said that even though I had four children and loved them dearly, I loved my husband more than I loved my children. That seemed to make everybody crazy.
Yes.
But you know who it didn't make crazy? A lot of women got very, very angry at me, a lot of young mothers, and I ended up on Oprah trying to defend myself against a studio full of them. But I also got these wonderful, wonderful letters and emails from people who had been married for a very long time, particularly widows. Widows who had lost their husbands after 50 years and wrote to me that was how they lived their lives. And they had these wonderful marriages and wonderful families, and that was the secret to their success. And that really made me feel good. And I also got a lot of emails and letters from clergymen of all various stripes, from Mormons to Jews to Catholics, saying, you know, what you're saying is hardly revolutionary. It is, in fact, in the Bible. The Bible does not instruct us to cleave to our children. So that was also mm-hmm. somewhat satisfying. I'm not mm-hmm. used to I'm quite progressive in my politics, and I'm not used to finding myself on Mormon radio being feted for something that I've said. And that was a really – they said, we'll just ignore all that gay marriage stuff you talk about, but we love that thing you said, marriage and motherhood.
Validated by clergy.
Yes. Yeah. It's good. It's good. I'm going to get a T-shirt that says that.
Yeah, there's three words for your six-word summary.
Yes, for my six-word bio. Yeah. Validated by clergy. Oh. Loathed by mommies.
Well, I think you're very brave.
Thank you.
Yes. And I'm so interested in the development in your writing.
Thank
that
you.
You've come into this the area that's a little bit new for you to be writing about the Holocaust.
Yes, and historical fiction. This is my first historical novel.
Uh-huh.
I'm Jewish, and I mm-hmm. grew up in a very traditional, not religiously traditional, but sort of typical Jewish family, which meant secular, really. Mm-hmm. And in the lives of American Jews, the Holocaust plays
right. –
it figures very large. I mean, it was something that I learned about a lot when I was a child in Hebrew school, and I read a lot of books. When I was a little girl and even as an adult, I read lots and lots of novels and memoirs about the Holocaust. And mm-hmm. I had been wanting to write about it for a very long time, but I didn't feel – confident in my own skill. And I was afraid to approach the topic because I was afraid that I would end up writing something mm-hmm. sentimental mm-hmm. and something that didn't honor that very great history. And by great, I don't mean wonderful. I mean large. And
yes.
So I waited. I waited until I felt I had, until mm-hmm. I had put in my Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours and I felt like I had the skill to approach it.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that there are other good books popping up about the Holocaust as well. I was thinking of Broken for You mm-hmm. and History of Love.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And I think that along with your book, those three are very accessible to book clubs.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's the great – you don't set out to write a book necessarily for an audience except maybe your own self, mm-hmm. I always try to write the book that I want to read. But what I love looking back now on this book is that it illuminates this period in history in a way that I certainly didn't know anything about it. My book has at its center the story of something called the Hungarian Gold Train,
yes.
which was a train full of the property of the Jews of Hungary that had been confiscated, everything from stamp collections to diamond tiaras and everything in between, furs and paintings and carpets and dishes. And all of that was confiscated by the fascist Hungarian government because the Hungarians were an ally of the Nazis. And it was sorted and loaded onto this train. And when the Russians invaded from the east, the train took off in the direction of Berlin. But of course, the war was ending, and the train just spent its time basically perambulating around Europe, one step ahead of various armies, until finally the Allies won the war, and the Hungarian bureaucrats and soldiers on the train realized that the last thing they wanted was to be found in possession of the accumulated wealth of a murdered people. And they basically tapped a passing soldier, American soldier officer, on the shoulder as he was passing by and said, "Hey, this is for you, and we're going to, get out of here. We're mm-hmm. going to melt off into the displaced persons camps, and you're not going to see us again. And you decide what to do with potentially $4 billion in today's currency worth of treasure, of loot, of looted property." Mm-hmm. And then the American government had to decide what to do with it. Do they give it back to the surviving Hungarian remnant now being governed by a Soviet army, who is, of course, immediately becomes America's enemy? Do they use it to support the health and welfare and feeding of the Jews who had survived the concentration camp, the 850,000 Jews who were living in DP camps in Austria and in Germany? Do they give it to the Jewish Agency to smuggle those DPs over the Austrian Alps into Italy and on the boats, like, you know, in the book and movie Exodus, to run the British blockade of Palestine. I mean, all of these people were vying for these the assets of the train, and it just made for such a rich, interesting story, and a great story against which to talk about things like, you know, what about identity and love, and what does it mean to love someone in the wake of a tragedy like the Holocaust, and what does it mean to try to define yourself as a person, as a Jew, as a woman, as a man in the wake of this huge monumental tragedy.
And so you bring into the scene your protagonist, Jack Wiseman,
yes,
an American serviceman, and give him the moral dilemma.
Yes, of what to do.
What good can come from this situation?
Yes, exactly.
Of this impossible situation.
He's caught there in the middle. Jack is assigned to guard the train. He finds himself acting as a requisitions clerk because the American generals who are stationed in Austria for the reconstruction and the Marshall Plan in Germany, and they are billeted in the homes of Austrian noblemen and wealthy people. And the Austrians, they were forced to turn over their homes, but they took all their stuff. They stripped their houses bare. And so, you know, imagine yourself an American army officer assigned now to Austria, and you have this empty house, and you don't have any sheets, and you don't have any cutlery, and you don't have any dishes. And there in a warehouse is this fantastic pile of stuff that you can start requisitioning. And Jack is left there dealing with both the woman he loves, who's a Hungarian Holocaust survivor, who her attitude is that belongs to the people of Hungary. That's my family stuff that you're blithely turning over to the generals and that everybody else is asking for. Historically, what ends up happening is that in reality, not just in my novel, many of those American brass, when they returned to the United States, rather than return the items that they had requisitioned, they packed them up and took them with them, which was part of this history of, you know, some people might have seen Monuments Men, which is this glorious story of the wonderful people, American Army officers who tried to track down lost art and return it to its rightful owner. But there was also a part of history we don't like to think about, which is that there was also a tremendous amount of looting. And this is one of those instances where our own soldiers looted. Now, I don't mean to denigrate the heroism
of
these people. I mean, Harry Collins is a great example. The general, the commander of the 42nd Infantry Division, the Rainbow Division. Mm-hmm. He is a national hero. He liberated Dachau, an incredible man. And also, he took a lot of that stuff home with him when he left Salzburg.
Mm-hmm. And each time that material changes hands, it's a little easier for people to rationalize it's okay to take
it
because they've removed it one more step.
Exactly. And the truth is, in Hungary, in the Hungarian countryside, 90% of the Jews were murdered in a brief 2-month period at the very end of the war. And in Budapest, about half of the Jews were murdered or died of starvation and famine and disease. So the chances are that the owners of those items are dead.
Are gone. Yeah.
So what does it mean? You know, it's easier to rationalize taking it when you know that. And also, to whom does it belong? And what is the value? I mean, we could say, oh, it's worth $4 billion. But what does that really mean? And I keep coming back to this thought, and this is really what inspired the novel for me. I have a pair of silver plate candlesticks that my great-grandmother smuggled out of Minsk under her skirts when she came to what they called the Golden Country, the Golden Medina, America. Now, those candlesticks are my most treasured possession.
Of course.
They're in a place in my home. They're invaluable. But really, what are they worth? Mm-hmm. And what would they have been worth if my great-grandmother had died and I had never been born? Well, you know, they're silver plate. Mm-hmm. They probably wouldn't have been worth very much. Mm-hmm. And when you think, well, what if they had been part of a pile of tens of thousands of similar candlesticks also belonging to people who had disappeared and vanished into ash and smoke? you know, it really sort of got to the heart of what we consider valuable and what we consider meaningful when the people to whom these items had value and had meaning are gone. And that's what I wanted to write about.
And while they may not be worth much, they're priceless.
Absolutely.
And so in your book, Love and Treasure, we leave the rail yards in, is it Salzburg?
Where Salzburg, that? Yeah.
In Salzburg. And we move to another venue, which absolutely delighted me. I came across in your writing five dwarf women, very good looking,
yes,
who had a band.
And their two brothers.
Oh, their two brothers.
Seven of them.
Seven dwarfs.
Yes.
And they were called the Lilliput Troupe.
Yes.
And then there was a riot at the opera.
Now,
where did that come from? That's
so
wonderful.
The story of those... that family, the Lilliput Troupe, is actually true. You know, I was writing that section of the novel, which takes place in 1913 in Budapest and is no doubt my favorite section of the novel. And it was missing something. And I couldn't think what it was. I couldn't figure out what it was missing. It had suffragists and revolutionaries and a psychoanalyst, a deluded psychoanalyst, but it was missing some little bit of magic. And my husband came home with a story, and he said to me, "You're not going to believe this. There was a family of vaudeville performing actors who happened to be dwarves. They were seven siblings, and they were from Transylvania. They were Hungarian speakers living in Transylvania, which was Hungary at the time and is now Romania. And they were deported to Auschwitz, where Mengele, who was, get this, yes, obsessed by the fairy tale Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, found them and then took them in and both tortured and protected them. So he experimented on them, but he kept them alive for his own bizarre and crazy experiments. He was very fascinated with this idea of dwarfism and you know, he fancied himself a scientist, although, of course, all of his science was just madness. And he experimented on them, and they were so brilliant. They would point out people, you know, average-sized people and say, "Oh, that's a cousin. That's a relative." People they knew, friends, anyone, because they knew they could save these people's lives. And he would bring them into his hospital and begin, you know, torturing and experimenting on them. But imagine you're at Auschwitz. To be tortured and experimented upon is better than being, you know, murdered right away. But in this way, this remarkable family of seven siblings saved countless others because they, you know, insisted that they were average-sized members of the same family. And then they survived, and they eventually immigrated to Israel, and they opened a movie theater in Haifa, go figure. And, I read the story, and I thought, oh, that's what I'm missing. And I invent a sister of, for my purposes, who is not only a singer and a vaudevillian, but is also a leading suffragist advocating for women's votes in Hungary.
I like the way you brought the suffragette in, because that fixed it in the period of time.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely. It was such an amazing, I knew that I was writing, I wanted to write about right before the war. And then I found this archive full of photographs of the International Conference on Women's Suffrage, which took place in Budapest in 1913. And there's this astonishing photographic record, all of these pictures. And the most amazing things, like the whole city feted and celebrated these visiting feminists. And, Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
Yes,
and
all
of her book, The Yellow Wallpaper, was hugely important to women at that time. And and then there's these great photographs. The mayor of Budapest deputized the Boy Scouts to be escorts to help the women, the feminists and suffragists, find their way around the city. So there are these young, you know, in their Boy Scout uniforms, these little boys with these very, you know, these wonderful women in these huge hats with these big shirt waists, and they are squiring them around the city, showing them from cafe to hotel. And it's just, the pictures are phenomenal, and the period was so exciting. And I just loved being able to include that in this novel.
Yeah. Now, I whisked you away from Salzburg before I gave you a chance to talk about the fact that Jack Wiseman finally succumbed and looted
Yes.
one...
He, One little thing, because it reminds him of the woman he loves.
He couldn't help himself.
He slipped this pendant in the shape of a peacock into his pocket. And it is this pendant that links the three sections of the novel.
That's why I knew we had to get it in there. Right.
And in the second section of the novel, Jack, who has reached the end of his life, tasks his granddaughter with taking the pendant and finding someone to return it to, finding an heir, finding someone who has a legitimate claim to this pendant. And she goes off to Budapest to try to fulfill this wish of her grandfather's. And that takes us into the middle section where Natalie, this young woman, and the man that she falls in love with try to do that. And that section is written almost like a caper. I love, I'm a huge fan of movies like Ocean's 11, and I wanted there to be a little bit of a caper in the middle of that, I got my start writing murder mysteries, so I like the idea of a little bit of that action in that section.
It was so interesting, the way that Natalie, the granddaughter, and Amitai, who was a bit of a scoundrel, how they were attracted to each other and how that developed.
So Amitai, I thought I made this up. I made up Amitai is an Israeli living in New York. He is a dealer in lost art. And he doesn't sort of work on behalf of people to repatriate art in any kind of moral way. What he does is he discovers art that's been lost during the Holocaust. He actually finds objects that are then found. So say he'll go to a museum and he'll see a painting. And then if he can trace a living heir to that painting, if there's no heir, he's not interested. But if he can trace a living heir, he will then go to the, say, small museum that's in possession of the painting and say, you are in the possession of a stolen piece of art stolen during the Holocaust. And if you want to avoid litigation, you will give me that painting, I will sell it, and I will divide the proceeds between you and the person who is the rightful heir. So you will get something rather than the nothing you will get if we take this to court. I thought I invented that most nefarious of professions.
No.
Not so much.
No.
There are, in fact, dealers who do precisely that. I couldn't believe it when I found that out, because I thought, this is surely so venal, so...
Nobody would do that.
Yes, nobody would.
Oh, yes.
But in fact, it turns out that you can never underestimate
That's
the
right.
greed of,
right.
our fellow humans. That's and there are people who do exactly that.
Mm-hmm. And since you're a graduate of Harvard Law, you can write with great skill the legal aspects
yes.
of that.
So that's always fun.
Bringing
in
another part.
I like to think that the nearly $100,000 I borrowed to pay for my legal education was not entirely wasted.
Of course.
So that I do use it in some ways.
Yeah. There's a lot in the book about art.
Yes.
And I wondered, I recognize some of the names, but not all of them.
Well, some of them I made up.
That's what
so
I wanted to ask you.
The painter who is – there's a lost painting.
Yes.
So that what brings Natalie, Jack Weissman's right. granddaughter, and Amitai, this Israeli art dealer, together is that Natalie's pendant that she's looking to repatriate is – there's a painting that Amitai has been looking for, a lost great painting that has the woman, the figure in the painting, is wearing a pendant that looks exactly like the one Natalie is holding. And Amitai believes that if he can trace the pendant, he can find the painting. And the painting is this work that he's been looking for years. And so I invented the artist, but I placed him in the school, the same sort of general area of painting and thought as Max Ernst, the surrealist,
right.
and as an heir in a way to the tradition of Klimt. And one of the reasons I got interested in the idea of art and lost art and the Holocaust was because of the very famous case of the Klimt portrait, the portrait of Frau Bloch-Bauer.
And hasn't someone just written a book about that?
Oh, have they?
Klimt?
I will have to find out about them. And that painting was a magnificent painting.
Yes.
And it and some other Klimts were held by the Austrian government in the Austrian National Museum. They had been taken from their Jewish owners, from the family of Adele Bloch-Bauer. And the Austrians' position was, well, we bought them. Well, you bought them, yes, but if one is holding a gun to someone's head and said, let me buy that painting for 50 cents, effectively, it's hardly a legitimate purchase. Mm-hmm. And the heir, the niece of the subject of the portrait who owned it sued, and after a very long litigation, not that long ago, just a number of years ago, eventually won, and she took possession of the portrait of her aunt. And then she sold it for something like $110 million to the Neue Gallery, where I have spent many hours looking at that painting, which I love. And I love that it's in a museum, mm-hmm. but it's an interesting to contemplate. Certainly it is more – it is a kind of justice. It just seems to me to be an unsatisfactory and poignant ending to a tragic story. And yet, on the other hand, I can go to New York and I can look at that painting mm-hmm. and it can inspire my work and the work of countless mm-hmm. others. And that is what we wanted more mm-hmm. than anything else, without any of the sense of that you're looking – you know, you could do that when mm-hmm. it was in Austria, but you felt when you were looking at it that you were looking at looted art. And now there – at least for that era, there isn't that mm-hmm. sense.
When the Second World War ended, people thought it was over. Then they thought, now everything will be all right, everything will be better. And that sort of thinking is completely unrealistic.
It's amazing the way that war has echoed in mm-hmm. our history.
That's
Look at what's happening in Ukraine,
that's
in the Crimea.
Right.
You know, we're harkening back to the First World
that's
War
right.
there. And
mm-hmm.
and in Hungary, for example, mm-hmm. a nationalistic, anti-Semitic right-wing party mm-hmm. has just taken 20% of their parliament, you know, with mm-hmm. the same kind of rhetoric that you heard, you know, 70, mm-hmm. 80 years ago. And it's just – it's heartbreaking mm-hmm. to think that we've made so little progress mm-hmm. and that these, you know, these mm-hmm. divisions between us are as vicious now mm-hmm. as they were so long ago.
Mm-hmm. And in a world where literally millions of people were killed in genocide –
tens of millions.
We can still be concerned about the morality of who those paintings belong to.
And why – I mean, I'm so curious about, like, why does art survive? The mm-hmm. Jews had everything stolen from them. That Hungarian mm-hmm. Togoltrian was full of everything mm-hmm. from a little boy's stamp collection mm-hmm. to a woman's diamond ring.
Mm-hmm.
So – but art survives, well, because it's identifiable mm-hmm. and because it increases in value. Mm-hmm. But I think also for a more poetic reason, because it has value even to someone to whom it is unconnected. It mm-hmm. evokes something even if it is not you, it doesn't belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, you know, those echoes remain forever.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Love and Treasure, brings so much with it. I mean, to read it is to become thoughtful.
Thank you.
The reason you located the Hungary. So
why Hungary?
Yeah, why Hungary?
I'm not Hungarian.
Yeah, right.
But I chose Hungary for such a silly reason, because a friend of mine had been named ambassador to Hungary, the American ambassador, and I really wanted to visit her and deduct the trip as a research expense for my taxes. So that's why I said it in Hungary. And you know, lucky for me, I found the story of the Hungarian gold train just waiting for me to come and poach it. I always tell Eleni that there was, you know, a greater power that decided where she would – you know, you don't choose where you're going to be made ambassador. And she had no connection to Hungary before. And I said it was, you know – there was something forcing you to spend 3 years in Hungary so I could get my research done and mm-hmm. deduct my trip to visit you.
Everything comes together when you're prepared.
Yes, exactly.
And you can use it in the writing. The book is called Love and Treasure, and I've been talking with the author, Ayelet Waldman, and it's just really been wonderful. Thank you
so much. It's
Thank
been
you.
A great pleasure for
Thank
me,
you.
Too.
Rosemary Manchester and Ayelet Waldman. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea, just part of the cultural programming you hear every Sunday afternoon and into the evening. We rotate with Gil Manserg's Word by Word and Word Temple, hosted by Sonoma County's Poet Laureate, Catherine Hastings. KRCB brings you high-quality, locally produced original programs on a daily basis, and we're happy to anchor the Sunday lineup, which includes Mouthful with Michelle Anna Jordan and Outbeat Radio as well. Your financial support inspires us and keeps us on the air, which is an integral contribution that you make to us. Call the station right now at 707-584-2020 and pledge your support for KRCB, the new 91. It's also easy to go online and choose a special gift to receive when you become a member of KRCB. While you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to A Novel Idea wherever and whenever you want to. I'm Suzanne Lang. Give us a call or go out to krcb.org. We'll be right back with Jenny Arvino and Remy Newman in Steamy Sonoma. Stay with us.
Every day I write the list of reasons why I still believe they do exist. A thousand beautiful things. And even though it's hard to see, the glass is full and not half empty.
Please call us right now, this moment, at 707-584-2020. Support KRCB and A Novel Idea through your financial pledge of support. Mothers are also lovers. And recently, Jenny Arvino and Remy Newman joined me in the studio to tell us about an upcoming event, Ménage à May, an erotic literary soiree, on Friday, May 30th, part of the Steamy Sonoma County series. Arvino's book, Poetry, Politics, and Passion, was a bold and frank accounting of her life, where she talks about sacred sexuality and promotes the concept of make love, not war. Remy Newman is a sexuality educator who has discovered the pleasure in writing and reading erotica, and together they have begun a series of erotic literary readings. In the past, Arvino has hosted aphrodisiac dinner parties, and both women see that as a society we sensationalize violence and deviance, yet remain uptight about healthy and meaningful sexual expression. And they are doing their part to bring out the warmth, the beauty, and sexual pleasure of erotic literature. Here's Jenny Arvino and Remy Newman.
I don't feel like I'm an expert in erotica. I feel like I wanted to start writing erotica because when I was married and my husband wanted us to watch pornography, read pornography, I found it so much of a turn off as opposed to a turn on that I wanted to find something that I thought was exciting to me.
So it wasn't because you read erotica that inspired you?
No. In fact, I saw pornography that turned me off. And so I wanted to find something that was either written in a style, a more artistic style, more, and being a writer, I'm looking for literary erotica. And I think that was part of what how Steamy started was mm-hmm. as a literary erotica. So that's where I was coming from, is that I was interested in writing something akin to the magazine way back when called Yellow Silk, which was erotic but yet beautiful literature, and it published a lot of the great writers at the time. And so that's what I was after, was literary erotica.
But there does seem to be a difference in how it operates. I mean, you talk about literary erotica, not necessarily literary porn.
Yeah, that's something that I think I would let people define for themselves. I remember reading, and I don't remember in which book it was, but the author Dorothy Allison said that the only difference between erotica and pornography is class. And I always think about that. So I think it does have something to do with how we just choose to define what turns us on and what we like. And for some people, it may make them uncomfortable to say, yeah, I like porn and that turns me on. But if it's not so uncomfortable for them to say, oh, yes, I read that book, 50 Shades of Grey, or I've read erotica, and I find, you know, that could be a turn on for me. So I think for some people, they may feel more comfortable calling something erotica because porn and pornography already has such a strong connotation in our society as something negative and also as something that has not traditionally been for women. So I think also
exactly.
some of it has come from that. But I think now there have been women who are turned on by what someone would call porn or pornography and, you know, still today could be. But I think I would leave it up to the individual to, if they want to, you know, read a magazine, or hardly anybody reads magazines anymore, but go online and watch a video and say it's erotic and call that, you know, looking at erotica, or read a story or a letter and say that's erotica. Or if they want to call it porn or pornography, I would not be the person to argue with them and say, define it. Nor even for people who are participating in it, you know, so us as authors, you know, if somebody wanted to call my writing porn, And they liked it, I'd say, sure, you can call it porn.
So, Remy, Jenny told us what inspired her about writing erotica. What about you?
Yeah, for me, it was a little bit different because I remember discovering a book of Yellow Silk and absolutely loving it. But also some just reading certain authors. The book that I was reading wasn't necessarily meant to be erotica or porn or to be a turn-on, but there would be a sex scene that I just thought was incredibly beautifully written, and I would gravitate towards that section of the book, and that's what would just part of what would hold a lot of meaning for me. And so I just, you know, I was already interested in writing. I was already a writer and very interested in sex and sexuality, and I'm a sex educator. So it just seemed like a perfect fit. And I just love all of the nuance that can be there, you know, the moments and the smells or the touch, the taste, whatever it is, all the senses and that can be explored when you have real characters in a real situation. So I just got inspired to want to also be able to write something like that, that could be meaningful to someone and also a turn on at the same time. So with my writing, I don't necessarily think of it as high literature, or I don't know. I do kind of think of it in terms of my attempt is to write something kind of like a one-handed read, you know, something that I'm hoping, I like the idea that somebody would read this and be turned on, you know, while they were reading it.
Well, I want to get to
to both of you reading in just a minute, but tell us more about Steamy Sonoma.
I'd love to. So I was invited to be a part of an erotic literary salon that takes place in Philadelphia that was started by a sexologist named Susanna Mayer. And it's a wonderful event that she does there monthly. And the last time I did it was over a year ago, and I just had such an incredible experience. It was a powerful experience to be standing in front of a room of people reading one of my stories and having the room be so quiet and just having all eyes on you. And I felt like you could have, you know, it's a terrible cliche, but heard a pin drop in that room. And I just had such a wonderful time. I said, I can't wait till I go back to Philadelphia again to have this experience. So why don't I start something like this here? I felt like I was sure there must be people who would be interested in having a similar kind of event in Sonoma County. So I got the idea to start Steamy Sonoma County and started reaching out, and was lucky and blessed to meet Jenny. And she's been there from the beginning, helping recruit people and organize. And so this is going to be our third one. This one that we have coming up is called Ménage en Mai. And it's going to be May 30th in Sebastopol. And there are tickets on sale now if you go to glittertix.com. And you can also look for us on Facebook. And please like our page on Facebook, Steamy Sonoma County on Facebook.
And where is it?
It's at a secret location.
It's a house party.
It's a house party.
I see. So you have to get
a
ticket.
So you buy the ticket and then, yeah, but it's basically, it's in Sebastopol.
Included with the ticket is food.
Yeah.
And we'll have an open bar and raffle prizes. And also there will be a chair dance lesson from Dangerous Dolly. Ooh. So there are lots of things besides reading that will happen at this event.
Tell us again, how do you get a ticket? Through Glitter?
Yeah, glittertix.com. And if you'd like to see more information, though, just look for us on Facebook. Look up Steamy Sonoma County. Or you can email us at steamysonomacounty@gmail.com. But it's going to be Friday, May 30th. Doors open at 7, and the readings will start close to 8 p.m.
All right. All right. Jenny, you brought something to read.
I was thinking that sometimes erotica is not so much talking about sexual acts per se, but sometimes it can just be focusing on the sensuality of encounters. And I think these poems have just a little bit of both. So we'll see what you think. It's just a three-part. It's just three little Valentines. One. Knelt over you like I was giving birth to your lips. You emerged dripping like Venus from the sea, a crust of salt on skin you carried evermore as a condiment. Two. Reaching for you is like reaching to pick a ripe mission fig, and finding gluttonous bees already there, eating out caves in your sweetness. But once I held your weight in my hand. As the moon soaked us in orchid light, I swallowed over and over the spilled seed of your anticipated future. Three. Under the tent of our umbrellas, I spoke, ebullient as a revival preacher, directly into your eyes. You studied faithfully my ministry of fingertips, my catechism of the kiss. We could be celestial as the choir I heard in San Gimignano, the highest pure note from a boy. You are a room full of light. When I walk in, I want to pray.
To watch Jenny Orvino read that is a reason to go to the event. And who are some of the other readers who might be there?
We will have Bill Noble, who's a friend of mine whom I met at the Human Awareness Institute. I have studied human sexuality and interrelationship for quite some years, beginning with my CD back in the year 2002, Make Love, Not War. And so I've always been interested in the relationship of sex and people and women especially. Bill Noble will be reading. He's a wonderful poet and a writer. He used to be an editor for CleanSheets.com online. And then we will have Michael Lorraine, who's a wonderful performer, and you may know him from Cotati, Flowers Not to Reason Why, the van selling flowers in the middle of Cotati. And, of course, we'll have Pink Lady. And we have a couple of new readers that Remy can tell you about.
Mm-hmm. We have Carmen Ayudan, and she's a up-and-coming young poet, and she's going to be reading, and possibly some others as well. So,
well, Remy, let's hear something from Pink Lady.
Okay. So this is something that I wrote a long time ago that was published in an anthology that was called Early Embraces 2, More True Life Stories of Women Describing Their First Lesbian Experience. This was actually the first piece of erotica that I wrote and submitted and had it published in a book. What inspired me to continue writing. Okay, so I'm going to start in the middle of the story, but this is called Three Women in a Tub. So me and two other women at this point are in a hot tub. I smiled as I let go of the strands of hair I had been nervously twisting. Moments later, I sensed movement in the water around me. I kept my eyes closed. I felt a hand touch my face and gently move it. As I was pulled closer, I smelled the familiar breath of Danielle. Her lips barely touched mine. I opened my mouth and reached for her lower lip, held it for a moment, and then eased my tongue inside the wetness. I put my hands on her shoulders as her arms encircled my waist. We held each other, savoring the sweetness of our first kiss. I had been with at least 30 men, but never had a kiss felt so soft. I have one of Bill Noble's poems that I can read. So, and this is one of my favorites. So this is by Bill Noble, and this is called A Small Poem About Tenderness. Tonight I would be the provider of solace, the caregiver, in the face of all that had afflicted you this day. But when you took me fully in your mouth, small, yielding, your encompassing warmth and sweetness, without urgency or agenda, every door opened, every hurt and hesitation was healed. I gave myself up to you, and you gave me myself, whole and at peace. Would you like to be inside? You asked, looking up from your giving. And in a moment you were above me, radiant, wordless, emptied of urgency and injury, and this thoughtless joy rose in my bones, this joy conceived in love, refracted in your eyes, easy as breath. Each day, each unfolding night, may we come to each other, healed, jubilant, and patient. Each day of all the days we may be graced with. May no hurt ever be stronger than the simplest act of love. May touch redeem us.
Thank you, Jenny Orvino and Remy Newman. Menage a May, an erotic literary soiree, is $25 to get in and includes food, an open bar, and an evening of erotic literature. Advance tickets are required. The event is Friday, May 30th, and you'll get the location once you've gotten your ticket through glittertix.com. And you can check them out on Facebook at Steamy Sonoma County. I hope you've enjoyed our Mother's Day edition of KRCB's A Novel Idea. Subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. And while you're there, become part of our radio community through your pledge of support. You can do that right online and choose your own thank you gift. Or call the station right now and let us know that you support KRCB, the new 91.
707-584-2020 is the number. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. Rosemary Manchester and I will be back next month. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. We can practice our lines till we're deaf and blind to ourselves, to each other, where it's fall, not winter, spring, not summer, cool, not cold. When it's warm, not hot, have we forgotten that we're getting is a novel idea.